All right. Welcome, everyone. Glad to see everyone here tonight. So with tonight's class, we start kind of a new unit in Genesis. We've been through Abraham and the various stories and chapters that relate the episodes of his life. And with the class tonight, we move on to another section in Genesis, which predominantly covers Abraham's grandson, Jacob. We'll talk a little bit more about the specifics of that here in a moment. If anybody needs any of the material for, and that consists of just kind of our reading questions, I have a few copies here. If anybody needs any of those, raise your hand. And then there are several copies in the back. Will you pass that down, please? Thank you. There are several copies in the back on the table too, if anybody needs any of those. So that covers basically the rest of our class period. We've got 9 classes left. If you notice, we've been doing this for 2 segments. We are at this point with where we left off on Sunday. In terms of chapters, we are right in the middle. So we've covered, we've taken about 17 classes or so to get halfway through the book. We're going to do the rest of the half in 9 chapters. And if you think the math on that is wrong, the only thing I can tell you is that we kind of planned it that way. But the point of that is that if you think it's been fast-paced up to now, we're going to speed the pace up a little bit. Hopefully, in terms of what we're reading and what we're discussing. And if Sam and I do a good enough job, we can present still the rest of the important points of the text and of the book to you as we go through these. So expect a little bit more pace as we discuss these things. If everyone's able to read the text before class, then that is certainly going to be helpful. You'll know what we're talking about. All right, so I wanted to start with a slide. I don't know if we've shown this slide yet since we've crossed over chapter 12 or not. I don't remember if we did. This is somewhat similar, if you remember back to a slide that we used in the first half of the class discussing the first 11 chapters. We talked about some of the themes and issues there and the different story cycles, both of Adam and Noah, that are covered in those first 11 chapters. There's something similar going on here in chapters 12 through 50. The bulk of Genesis focuses on the history of the patriarchs, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and then Jacob's children, specifically Joseph. The point in this entire section of Genesis is to establish God's plan to redeem his creation through what I said is a single entity, that being Abraham, but then the children of Abraham through a specific, grandson, which becomes the namesake of the chosen nation that would become God's people, and that's Israel. So through Abraham and through Israel, God is redeeming the creation, redeeming the world that was essentially lost over the first 11 chapters of the book. These chapters are characterized by God's gracious covenant with Abraham and through his chosen people, and then their response of faithfulness. At least that's what we've seen so far on Abraham's part. And we will see that in its own different kind of ways in discussion of the characters of Jacob and Joseph. It's not as obvious as it is there with Abraham, but it's still there. So, somewhat similar, hopefully you can see that. There are 3 main story cycles here in these chapters. We've already talked about the chapters with Abraham. Tonight we start in on the chapters dealing with Jacob, which run from the middle of chapter 25 through the middle of chapter 36. And then starting in chapter 37 and through chapter 50, we have the stories that are primarily dealing with Joseph. So, with Jacob, we're dealing with primarily his sort of like hijacking of the familial blessing, and we'll see that tonight, hopefully. And then much of the story of Jacob has to do with his interaction with Laban when he goes off to his uncle's household up in the east to and certain things that happen there that are really kind of the misfortune and then the rescue of Jacob in those stories. So there are kind of three main sections here in chapters 12 through 50. So that kind of sets the context for where we are, right? We've been through the stories of Abraham, the establishment of the covenant, the various promises that God has made. That's going to be now carried forward. Those same themes are going to be carried forward as God repeats those promises. He's going to repeat them to Isaac in one point that we'll see briefly tonight, but then those promises are really reaffirmed to Jacob, and the promises are made to Jacob that he would be the one through whom the promises would be fulfilled. I want to go back to another slide that we taught that I had in the very first class that we had done in segment one, talking about some of the themes in this book. The stories with Jacob, I think, really kind of emphasize these, not only all of them, but as deep as you're going to find them in Genesis, you're going to find them in the stories of Jacob. First of all, this idea that you know, patriarchal history is about divine promise. And if you remember way back when, we talked about the idea that God's promise is sovereign, it is marked by His faithfulness, and it is marked by covenant. God establishes covenant with His people based on God's decision and God's decision alone, and God is the one who is faithful to that covenant, in some cases, regardless of the response of the person that He makes those covenant promises to, although that is obviously the appropriate response. So, again, these stories are going to be dominated by God as the sovereign one who establishes a covenant with Jacob. A couple of things that we're also going to see here is we talked about from the beginning this idea, and we've seen it already with Abraham, right? Abraham, twice over, has tried to rescue himself from the hands of a foreign king by lying about the identity of his wife, whom he calls his sister. We see that repeated for a third time, amazingly, tonight in his son Isaac. But there's no character in the Bible that is much of a trickster, as much of a deceiver as is Jacob. And we'll talk about that, because that can be somewhat conflicting, that the one through whom God gives the promise is one who gains blessing by deceit, and is both he and his children are frequently involved in kind of trickery and deception, both to their detriment but also to their benefit too. So we'll talk about that a little bit. And of course, Jacob over Esau is probably the primary instance in the book of Genesis of this idea of reversals, that so often, so frequently, God privileges the younger over the older in this book. And we see that as a repeated pattern over and over again. And this is probably the most obvious example of that. We see things about name meanings, especially when we get into the chapters where Jacob's children are born. They all have a really important meaning to their name. And obviously, ancestry and land are really important too. One of the things about land that I'll bring us back to here is... when God calls Abraham, right, he calls Abraham from the east over here in Ur and calls him over, and there's a place where Abram and his family dwell in this area of Haran, right here, right, in Padan Aram. You've seen, if you've read tonight, you've seen both of those place names. So when God calls Abraham, He calls him down here into this area, and this is the area of Canaan that God promises to Abraham and to his descendants. This is the subject of the promise that God gives. And throughout the stories of Abraham, Abraham is dwelling in this general area of the world, right? Abraham goes north and south, east and west, to and fro over the land. And that's significant, right? That God calls Abraham to this portion of land and says, this is going to be the promised land that I'm going to give to your descendants. Well, with the story of Jacob, you actually have sort of the undoing and the redoing of that. In that when after Jacob takes the birthright from Esau and after he takes the blessing from his father Isaac, Jacob has to run, right? He's got to run away. And where does he go, right? He's down here in the land. he comes all the way back up here, right? This is where his uncle Laban lives. And on the way, you've got Jacob encountering God, and Jacob makes a vow that says, God, if you'll allow me to return, then you know, you will be my God, and all of those promises will be fulfilled. So you have this notion that you know, in his hour of travail and conflict, Jacob is leaving the promised land, and yet when he is rescued, and when he returns, that's sort of a symbolic action that he's coming back into his homeland. He's coming back into the area that God has promised for him. So the geography of this story is really important too. Something that you probably don't catch in any one particular verse, but the overall context of that is important. That Jacob leaves and goes back to the area from which his grandfather had been called, and then returns to the promised land that God has given. So, again, we're kind of giving an overview here of what is going on in these stories of Jacob, right? Before we get into the particulars. And I'm hoping tonight to be able to get through at least chapter 27. And if we don't, then that's fine. We can cut corners somewhere else. Inevitably, we'll have to do that at some point along the way. So the things that we talked about earlier about how the themes of Genesis are really kind of wrapped up in Jacob, I think those things are true in spite of the fact that Jacob is not a good guy in the traditional sense, you know, within the story of the Bible. He is a good guy in the sense that he is the one through whom God makes promises. But Jacob's moral character is questionable at a number of places. Jacob is a schemer. He's a scoundrel. He's a rogue. I was talking to Steve Wolfgang, and Steve said, and worst of all, he's a mama's boy. Jacob's behavior at any one point is not very exemplary. I read one commentator that puts it this way. He says, the narrative about Jacob portrays Israel in its earthiest and most scandalous appearance in Genesis. The narrative is not edifying in any conventional religious or moral sense. Indeed, if one comes to the narrative with such an agenda, the narrative is offensive. Meaning, if we come to Jacob looking for Jacob to be some kind of example of moral quality, that's not what we're going to find, right? And if we take Jacob to be that, then we end up sort of skewing our idea of what's right and wrong. And so all of these stories together, I think, present us with a little bit of a problem, which is, you know, what do we do with not only Jacob, but all of these stories as a whole? What kind of lessons can we learn from them? And at a holistic level, I think there are a couple of things. Number one is that God is certainly faithful to his sovereign choice. And I think we're going to see that from the very first story about the birth of Esau and Jacob. We've already seen to some extent that, you know, that God is faithful to his promises. But within that idea, God is going to act in ways that we don't quite understand, but which serve his purposes, right? No matter what, God is going to continue to act in accordance with the promises that he makes, no matter what. If you remember, that's exactly the point that Paul makes in Romans chapter 9, referring back to the Jacob and Esau story and the proclamation that God makes to their mother. Remember, Paul says that God's choice is not because of works, but because of him who calls, right? Not because of works, but because of him who calls. So, for that reason, I think it's important to remind ourselves that God's choice to bless Abraham, remember this, God's choice to bless Abraham was not based on Abraham's faithfulness or Abraham's righteousness. That's not why God chose Abraham. God chose Abraham because God did. There was no sort of moral quality or prerequisite, you know, qualification that Abraham fulfilled to be able to earn that. That was a matter of God's grace and choice. And that's no less the case with Jacob, despite the fact that Jacob sometimes acts in ways that are not qualitatively good. A second thing that I think is important is that God's choice or election doesn't mean, it sometimes means, and we'll see that a little bit later, but it doesn't always mean that, you know, you're going to turn out to have what we might call a good life, right? Jacob's life doesn't turn out well for him at the beginning, right? In the face of God giving the promises to Jacob and Jacob receiving the blessing of his father and receiving the promises of God, Jacob's family life doesn't turn out well for him at the beginning. It's marked by conflict with his brother and with his uncle. It's marked by conflict and fear. Jacob, I think we'll see a number of times in these early stories, talks about how afraid he is with his encounters with, you know, not only God, but with Laban, and then later on with Esau when he returns to the land, right? Jacob is an example that God's plan, if we want to use that terminology, often works through pain, maybe even a lifetime full of pain. That's exactly why I think Jacob turns out to be the perfect namesake for Israel, right? Israel becomes the nation that takes on his name and is the one who sort of frequently wrestles with God throughout their history, and their existence kind of doesn't find a better exemplar than Jacob. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good parallel with Samson. I think that's right. Did you have something? No? Okay. Never mind. All right. All right. So a couple of other things here, just to kind of do a little bit of a comparison or a contrast between Abraham and Jacob. In the Abraham stories, most of those stories were about the relationship between a father and his son, or really even there, his potential son, right? The building of that, of those stories is Abraham ever going to have a son to be able to fulfill the promise? With the Jacob stories, it's not about father-son, it's mostly about brother relationship and other types of familial relationships, right? Again, we mentioned this earlier. Abraham's sojourn is within the land of Canaan, and Jacob's is away from Canaan and back to it, right? Inasmuch as you can separate the concepts in Genesis of promise and blessing, I think Abraham is really about the promise, that God makes the promise and is working to fulfill that. Jacob is doing that, but that is clearly sort of a long-term goal by the point we reach Jacob. Jacob is more concerned with blessing and mostly sort of gaining earthly blessing, something that is kind of always, you know, one step ahead of him. And again, I think with Abraham you see a character that is primarily identified through the notion of sacrifice. We can think of, you know, his giving the preference of the land to Lot, of course, willingness to sacrifice his son, and yet Jacob is involved both as the perpetrator and the victim of trickery and deceit, and that's kind of what marks his life. Just in terms of an outline of what we're going to see here, the bulk of the stories about Jacob have to do with just his conflict and resolution between Esau on one hand. That sort of starts and ends most of the narrative, and then in the middle of that you have him going off again to Padan Aram and living in the household of his uncle Laban, and there's more conflict, and then he's able to escape from that situation. But in the middle of those things you've got some really significant events that happen to Jacob. He meets the Lord at Bethel on his way away from his home and up to the household of Laban. He's going to meet God at Bethel. That's going to be a significant point. Within the household of Laban, he's going to bear children, and those are going to be very important for the latter part of Jacob's life. When Jacob, after all of this is kind of resolved, Jacob eventually kind of gets redeemed by the lives of his children. The birth of those children takes place there when he is within the household of Laban. You'll remember We'll talk on Sunday about the situation that kind of led to that. And then there's a major event that happens in 32 where on the way back from there, before he meets his brother again, Esau, and they reconcile, he meets with God again. In fact, he wrestles with God in what is a really great story. This meeting at Penuel where he wrestles with God and his name is changed to Israel, that's a really important event. And then there's some concluding things within this sort of cycle from 33 to 36, some other stories having to do with Jacob's children, and Esau is actually given a very lengthy genealogy at the end of this section. Esau is kind of redeemed in his own way in Genesis, just through the massive genealogy in chapter 36. So, you know, memorize that. So that's where we're going as we talk about these stories. So before we even get into the Jacob stuff, like I said, it kind of starts in chapter 25, in the middle of chapter 25, and verse 19. We talked about in the beginning that much of Genesis is marked off by these statements. These are the descendants of, or this is the story about, or these are the generations of, verse 19, these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. And this marks kind of actually the beginning of the Jacob story, right? The story of Isaac, Abraham's son, or the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son, is about Jacob. We saw that similarly where all of the Abraham stories were under the heading of, this is the generations of Terah, Abraham's father, right? Something similar here. So it starts in chapter 25, and we immediately move into the story about Jacob and Esau, but then in chapter 26, there's kind of an immediate interruption into that where we get a chapter that's all about Isaac. I actually want to start in chapter 26 and we'll come back to 25. I want to touch on this just a little bit because this is the chapter in Genesis where Isaac is really kind of focused on as an individual. We always think of it as Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and rightly so, but in terms of actual content in the book, Isaac is only given really one chapter where he's not like identified as either Abraham's son or Jacob's father, right? This is kind of a standalone chapter within the book that deals solely on Isaac himself. And what's fascinating and bewildering about this chapter is the fact that you have a repeat of the two stories that we've already seen in chapters 12 and 20, I think, where Abraham, again, lies about the identity of his wife. You have Isaac doing the same thing, and apparently doing it to the same person. I've seen one argument that suggests that this Abimelech is actually a different person who is maybe, you know, a son or a grandson of the Abimelech in chapter 20. I don't know whether that's right or wrong. But in either case, you have an expansion on that story where Abraham lies to Abimelech, king of Gerar. Here you have Isaac lying the same lie to either the same person or the same position, and so you have kind of a repeat of that and then an expansion of that, because this story goes well beyond that. This story kind of leaves off the consequences of what happens in those events, and we've talked about those in chapters 12 and 20, so I don't want to get too far into those, but You know what we've said about that and the you know, negative light that put on Abraham and here on Isaac. The focus on that in this chapter is really just kind of set up what happens after that, right? But before that, it's interesting that in this chapter, again, this is kind of the standalone chapter for Isaac, you do have God in two places repeating the covenant promises that he had made to Abraham to Isaac, right? So in chapter 26, verses 3 to 5, reside in this land as an alien, the Lord says to Isaac, and I will be with you and will bless you. For to you and to your descendants I will give all these lands, and I will fulfill the oath that I swore to your father Abraham. I will make your offspring as numerous as the stars of heaven, and will give to your offspring all these lands, and all the nations of the earth shall gain blessing for themselves through your offspring, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. You guys hear, as we read that, the repetition of what God had said to Abraham. You hear the repetition of that in the words to Isaac. And even the idea that God makes these promises to Isaac on the basis of Abraham's faithful obedience, right? Verse 5, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. And in light of those blessings, and in light of what occurs at Gerar there, God blesses Isaac with great material wealth. You see that in at the end of, starting in verse 12. Isaac sowed seed in that land, and in the same year reaped a hundredfold in a year. Don't gloss over how amazing that is. The Lord blessed him, and the man became rich. He prospered more and more until he became very wealthy. And then it lists kind of his possessions and the things that he has there. So, great material wealth. Isaac becomes a wealthy man at the hands of Abimelech and his region, his nation. And then you've got a story here where Isaac's servants come into conflict with the herdsmen in Gerar, and they fight over the wells and the water rights in the area. And eventually that results in a treaty between Isaac and Abimelech. Here again you have this sort of concept of conflict and resolution between Isaac and Abimelech. So we don't have a whole lot of time to get into the specifics of that chapter. It is kind of odd that it's positioned here in chapter 26. You would think the Genesis would go right from the story about Jacob taking Esau's birthright right into him taking the blessing from Isaac, but this chapter kind of splits that down the middle. It's not entirely clear why that's here, although it probably fits in chronological order. But there's a juxtaposition here of... I think one thing that this does highlight is, you know, in chapter 25, you get the sense that Isaac is going to sell his birthright. We'll talk about exactly what that means, but it's important then that birthright is fairly substantial, given that Isaac has a great amount of wealth. So that's one important thing to kind of keep in mind as we move forward. All right, so we hit on that. Let's turn back to chapter 25. All right, so again, we're gonna pick up in 21, and we have a familiar problem, right? The problem all the way through the stories of Abraham was that he couldn't have children, that Sarah couldn't bear a child, that Sarah was barren. And lo and behold, you have the same problem here in verse 21, that Isaac's wife Rebekah was barren. I don't know if there's anything more to this, but in this case, you know, so the Abraham story took about 12 chapters to resolve that. Here it's done in about 12 words. Isaac prayed to the Lord because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer, and his wife Rebekah conceived. So you got that problem overcome fairly quickly. But then the problem is that as Rebekah goes through the pregnancy, she has a struggle within her womb. I obviously don't know sort of the physiological specifics of that. But it says that her response is that she went and inquired of the Lord Yahweh, and then the Lord Yahweh speaks to her. And what it says to her, I'll just put that back to you. What are the things that are revealed to Rebecca here? I've got three things that were revealed. Right. So there's actually two things on that, right? There's not just one, there's two, right? So one revelation is it's twins, surprise. And then the other one is that those children are the ancestors of two nations, right? So there's an import to these children from that perspective. And what else? What's the last thing that she's told? Right, the older will serve the younger. So, you know, this kind of has a double meaning to it, right, as most prophecies of the Old Testament do. It not only speaks to the fact that Esau is going to serve Jacob, or that Jacob will receive the rights and the blessings of the firstborn son, even though he will not be the firstborn son, but it also has the meaning that, you know, these these two nations that exist. You know, the nation that stems from Esau is going to serve the nation that stems from Jacob. There's actually a third meaning to this that we get out of the New Testament. We've already referred back to Romans 9, but if you look back at that chapter, Paul uses this very word, right? The elder shall serve the younger, in Romans chapter 9, as a precedent for God's choice to reveal the gospel to Gentiles. So this is an instance where, you know, one statement of the Lord has multiple valences of meaning, which is an interesting... I could talk about that more, but I'll leave that alone. So I think it's important that what God is saying here kind of overturns this natural or cultural concept of primogeniture, which is the rule of the firstborn. That the firstborn in any family has an automatic, culturally established privilege. That concept is something that we don't really deal with in our own day and time, as much of the stuff in this story is. These are very sort of culturally bound things, and so we'll have to take some time to explain those. But that idea about the privilege of the firstborn is a fundamental conviction. It's a way of sort of structuring the family life. It's a way of structuring the culture of the day. And yet God is sort of overturning that. He's undoing that here in this statement that the older shall serve the younger. So God is sort of undoing that through this. So Rebekah gives birth to these children, and we're told, and this will be significant in the story in chapter 27, but we're told about their physical appearance, right? Esau is red or ruddy, and he's very hairy. In most representations of this, you have Esau as a big guy with red hair. It may or may not be that his hair was red. The statement is that he was red and he was hairy, for whatever that means. What it does mean, this is kind of typical of what we've seen in Genesis, is that those things lead to what his name is. And actually the name Esau is a combination of the Hebrew words for red and hairy, right? The word red, we're going to see this later, the word red is actually a word that is going to come to mean Edom, and that's going to be the name of the nation that comes from Esau's line, is the nation of Edom. And that word has an etymological connection with the word red. And then the word hairy refers to the land of Seir, which is the place where Esau eventually comes to reside. So you smash all that together, and you get the name Esau. Jacob, on the other hand, oh, and by the way, Esau becomes a man who is a skillful hunter, a man of the field. And for that reason, he kind of earns the love of his father Esau, who we're told, interestingly, has this fondness for game or meat, right? So he privileges Esau over Jacob because Esau feeds him what he likes to eat, right? Jacob, on the other hand, comes out with... I saw that. Jacob, on the other hand, comes out with a really interesting symbolic action. Jacob comes out holding on to the heel of his brother. We saw that in the womb they were fighting together, and it seems from this action that, you know, Jacob is fighting all the way even out of the womb. I think holding on to the heel is an action that means he is trying to hold Esau back. He's trying to almost pull him back in so that he could be the first one. And so Jacob's name means one who grabs the heel, or the verbal form of that is one who tries to supplant or restrain or overtake. That's what Jacob's name means, and it is appropriate for who he's going to become. And we're told that Jacob is, most translations put this as a quiet man. This word actually, in some cases, means sort of morally upright. It doesn't really mean that here. For instance, this is a word described of Job early in Job. Job is described as a righteous man. It's the same word here, but that's not what it means for Jacob. What it means is that he's a quiet man, that he's a mild-mannered person. He's domesticated. where Esau is going to become a hunter of the field, Jacob is going to deal with goats and sheep, more domesticated animals. So we already know a lot of things about Esau and Jacob and who they're going to become just from the moment of their birth, right? Sort of these symbolic things about their birth almost tell the full story of who they'll become. All right. Probably the most famous story about, or you know, 1A and 1B, the story about Esau selling his birthright to Jacob. So we've already seen a couple of cases in Genesis of brotherly fraternal rivalry, right? We've seen Cain and Abel. We've seen Ishmael and Isaac. I think it's interesting to note that in both of those cases, too, you have the one who, in the outcome of those stories, the one who is seen as the righteous one is Abel and Isaac. What do those two have in common? They were the younger brother. Here we have that again, in maybe its most famous form here. A younger brother emerging favorably over an older brother. So we're told Esau is a skillful hunter, right? Well, he wasn't that skilled, because one day he comes home with nothing, right? And he comes home and he says that he's famished. And what's interesting in verse 30 is the way that this kind of shows up in the original about just how Esau expresses this. The word for, you know, let me eat is actually a word that suggests he's just going to gulp down the whole pot of stew in one big gulp, right? He's just like, give it to me now. I'm just going to swallow it whole. And what he calls it is not stew or, you know, food or anything like that. He says, give me the red stuff. And he repeats it, the red stuff. Give me that red stuff. Whatever it is, I don't care. You just give it to me. And again, a note here, sort of a parenthetical note in verse 30, therefore he was called Edom. Again, a connection between his name and the color. And so Esau comes home with nothing and is famished, is exhausted from the hunt that did not turn out well, and is just seemingly dying of hunger. And Jacob is really opportunistic here, right? The first instance that we have of Jacob is, I mean immediately, it's like he's been waiting for the moment, right? Jacob says, first sell me your birthright. So this notion of birthright is interesting. It's associated, like we said, with the firstborn male of the family. From my understanding, what it refers to is the idea that at the division of the estate of the father, that the older son gets 2/3 of the inheritance, gets the double portion of the inheritance, and the other son or the remaining sons deal with the other third of the inheritance. So this is, I think, primarily, it's going to be connected with the idea of blessing that we'll see in chapter 27. But I think primarily the idea here is that Esau selling his right to take the bulk of the estate. And as we've seen, Isaac is a wealthy person, is a wealthy man. So what Esau sells here is not unimportant from a spiritual perspective, just as much as a physical perspective, right? Esau stands to inherit a lot of money, a lot of wells, a lot of animals. That he uses to become a wealthy person himself, and yet he's willing to give that up over a bowl of soup, right? So what he gives up is really important, and you'll notice that Jacob is really insistent on making sure that this is not just something that Esau throws away with a line and tries to backtrack on it, right? He makes him swear that he's going to do it, and Esau readily complies. Well, I probably didn't state that correctly. I think there is an element in which it is connected with the blessing that the Father is going to give. The blessing has more to do, and we'll see this in a minute, the blessing has more to do with kind of the outcome or the destiny of the child and who they will be. The birthright is sort of one way to symbolize that. They kind of are two sides of the same coin. This, I think, has to do with what Esau stands to inherit. Okay. So Esau agrees, and Jacob gives him the food, and maybe Esau was right? He ate, he drank, he rose, he went his way. It's done. In one verse, right? And then the concluding statement: Esau despised or spurned or repudiated his birthright. He disregarded it. He counted it as nothing. We don't have time to go over to the parallel or the commentary on that in Hebrews. But Esau is certainly not portrayed in a positive light in this story, just willingly giving that up as if it was nothing. Yep. Sure. All right, so let's start. I know we've only got a few minutes. Let's start in this story in chapter 27 about Jacob stealing, is the right word, stealing his father's blessing. Jacob has the birthright, but that's not all that he needs. He needs to overcome his father's love of Esau in order to receive the blessing of the family. So we're told that Isaac is, at this point, he's old and he's blind. And he sends out Esau to hunt so that he can prepare this food that Esau loves. What amounts to what Isaac at least thinks is like his final meal, it seems like, right? And the intention there is that at the eating of that meal, Isaac is going to bless Esau. The blessing here, maybe even more than the concept of birthright, is foreign to our sort of rational, individualistic culture. In our world, we privilege things like, you know, initiative and making your own way in the world, and that a person has their own say in the outcome of their life, and that their life is a result of the choices that an individual person makes. That's not really what's going on here with the blessing. In fact, it's about 180 degrees from that. The blessing is a way for the family to establish and set in motion the destiny of their children. Parents have a direct say in the destinies of the lives of their children, right? We see that kind of thing in the notion of arranged marriages and things like that. The blessing doesn't work on an altogether dissimilar level from that. And the blessing of this family is more important, right? Because the family blessing here comes with the promises that God had made to Abraham and to his descendants. I want to skip a little bit ahead here at the very end, because I think to understand the importance of the blessing, we need to put ourselves in Esau's shoes at the end of this, right? Esau, upon learning that Jacob has done this, cries out to his father and he says, "Bless me also. You can bless me too," right? Or, do you only have one blessing? Can you not bless me as well? And I think to me, anyway, in reading the story, one of the natural things that I would think is, well, why? I mean, Isaac knows that this was done falsely. Why can't he renege on what's been done? Why can't he undo it, considering that cheating was involved in the outcome here? And the answer, I think, is because that's just not how the blessing works. In this way of doing things, words have definitive power. They mean things and they can't be undone. They have genuine authority, and they definitively set what the destiny of that child is going to be, and they set that person up to fulfill those words. Those words mean things and they can't be undone. Isaac can't take back the blessing any more than he can make himself see. Right? So that's where we stand in this story, and we'll continue to cover it on Sunday. But that's sort of the import of where we stand on this, right? That Jacob is taking something which can't be undone and which is going to set who he's going to become for the rest of his life. And the way that he does it is going to set the tone for the remainder of his life as well. So we'll get into the deception that was involved in that on Sunday. Yeah.